Jacqueline Malcolm.
Okay, well, we did not go far, and I hope you enjoyed that music, but right now we are back in the studio, and sitting with us right now, we're very, very excited to have with us Leon Bosch. Hello, Leon.
Good morning.
How are you today?
Fabulously well. I'm pleased to be here.
Yes, yes. Now, I'm going to say straight away, because I know that you are South African,
yes,
and yet you've got this strongest English accent. So we're gonna have to learn all about this story.
Yeah, look, the accent has always been the same ever since I was a kid.
Oh, really?
Nothing has changed. I've always spoken like this. I've not been influenced by living in the United Kingdom for the last 37 or 30, however long I've been.
Well, exactly. Because I've got a few South African friends and Australian friends, and the one thing about accents that wherever you were born, it's like that's the one. Whatever takes hold as a child, that's the one that seems to stay with you, unless you're like a chameleon and you're really good at just
Look, there's always a kind of, for anybody with a really finely tuned ear, they can find a little bit of the Cape Tonian in this.
Right.
But there's a universal English accent that, pervades the whole world.
Right.
And that's what I think I picked up as a kid.
Well, this is what you have.
Yes.
This is what you have. Okay, so we've got to start. I mean, just reading about you, it's like, makes your eyes water. You know what I mean? You've got such a vast and exciting and amazing contribution to music that you've given. I mean, it's...
I never really thought about it till recently. One of my friends asked me about how I would, if I look back, what do I see?
Yes.
And I realized that a lot of things have happened. I started off life with, I wanted to be a lawyer, but I was not granted permission to go to university to study law in South Africa, because in the apartheid years, you used to have a permit to study at university.
Right. And now to get this in context, because you were brought up during the apartheid,
exactly,
in South Africa.
Yes.
And for those who were living in some kind of land, or maybe they're too young to have heard about it, I don't know, maybe
yes,
we are now hitting that generation that may be, but...
We are in danger of forgetting history. And of
exactly.
course, I'm still very much alive. It wasn't that long ago.
Right.
And yet there's a collective amnesia about what really took, what happened.
Well, we do love to forget certain things. We do as humanity. We like to say, well, yes, that happened, but look, we're over it now, and let's not.
Exactly.
And yet, we're not talking long ago.
And the important thing to remember is that it is history that informs the future. If we
yes.
forget our history, then we will
there you go.
Make the same mistakes.
We're going to just keep repeating.
Exactly.
So,
whilst living in South Africa, I realized that we lived in a social arrangement which was unacceptable.
Right.
The system of apartheid was and I dedicated my life to opposing it.
Right.
And at the age of 15, which that was 1976, it was the year of the very big uprisings in South Africa. And
right.
Most people probably remember the photograph of Hector Peterson, the first victim to be shot.
Right.
In the 1976 protest. Well, I decided, along with my friends at school, I was in this student representative council, that we were going to have a march onto Parliament in Cape Town.
Right.
That I found it was no longer useful just to protest inside the perimeter fence of our school. And we marched onto Parliament in Cape Town. But unfortunately, the South African police opened fire with live ammunition on the crowd, and they killed a lot of people.
Wow.
And I was arrested by Special Branch shortly after that. And
how old were you? Wait. How old were you at this point?
I was 15.
15 years old.
Yes. But at the age of 15, I was willing to want to change the world. And the consequences didn't matter.
This is amazing.
So ending up as a prisoner, it taught me a lot.
Of
how
course.
To survive security police, interrogation, and also isolation. When the door is closed behind you in a cell, it is as if your world falls apart, because you have no idea when it's going to finish, whether you will get out.
Yes.
Or whether you'll be alive.
Right.
And that's
the whole sense of time changes, isn't it? Because it's not like you're looking at a time. You don't have a watch. You don't have a clock.
No.
So you're not ticketing the time like we do
exactly.
when you're free.
Yes.
And so suddenly you're just left with you in silence and your thoughts.
Precisely.
And you're 15 years old.
I was 15 years old. And there were other people involved in me eventually in this. I was arrested alone and interrogated alone and badly treated. But eventually I was charged. And the charge sheet read Leon Bosch and 9 others. There were 10 of us involved in this trial. And 40 years later, the youngest prisoner, who was 14, arranged a reunion for all of us
wow.
in the cell where we'd been held together eventually.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's truly grotesque. And I have some photographs of that cell. And I look at them, I'm horrified. But Anwar Omar, who was the prisoner who arranged this reunion 40 years later, reminded us that in the corner of that cell was a toilet. And that the 9 of us in the cell, not only did we have to use the toilet in front of everybody else, we also had to wash from it every morning.
But not that was also your basin to wash.
Exactly. But even worse, we had to drink from it because they deprived us of food and water. And when I was reminded of that, I saw red, just for a second.
Yes.
And at that moment, just for a split second, I believed in the death penalty. But right. The feeling soon went away. And I realized that those monsters that had done this to us were still walking free. There'd be no justice. And I think we have to revisit what really happened in South Africa. Because, as I said earlier, it's easy to have this collective amnesia. It's as like it never happened.
Right. But it very much did happen.
Indeed.
And people are still being affected by it.
Precisely.
People are still living sure. with the memory of it.
It never goes away.
Well, no.
In that cell, with the reunion, the television cameras were with us. They made a program about it. And everybody was asked how they felt about what had happened. And without exception, they said that that experience has scarred every single day of their life since then.
Wow. I'm not really surprised. I'm not really surprised. So being 15 years old and going through that horrific experience, how did you rise above it and still keep a hold of your own identity to become, to move on, to become not this bitter, angry person, but to this person who still wants to change the world, who still sees hope in the world? How did you maintain this?
I mean, the fundamental thing I learned was the question of principle. It was principles that guided me throughout life. I would always fight for what was right. It didn't matter what the cost. And when I was refused permission to become a lawyer, it didn't matter because I could represent the underdog in a different way. And the
right.
underdog that I represented all my life was the double bass, the musical instrument that I've played since I was 16.
Wow.
So, when somebody suggested I should play the bass, I thought they were crazy. But within a short period of time, this was the University of Cape Town, as a music student, in a hostile environment. I had a permit to study there, and I traveled from the townships to music college.
Right.
It might as well have been a different planet. It was so different to the townships. To the,
exactly. So now, did you get this permission because you would be... I only know this because this was questioned to me one time by a South African. Would you have been considered coloured? So therefore you were given...
On the birth certificate that I still have in my filing cabinet home, Leon Bosch, Cape coloured. I'm categorized by that kind of racial epithet,
wow.
which is an insult and a disgrace, and these things haven't been changed.
Yes.
At least my birth certificate has not been changed to acknowledge my humanity.
There you go. So you are cape-colored.
But okay. You see, everybody had to live under this restriction of you had to have special permission to study at university.
Right. What, even anything. White people?
No, no. White South Africa could do anything.
Right, that's what I thought.
Utter freedom
to be human and to live their lives.
Yeah.
But anyone of any colour, of any race, as long as they were not Caucasian in any sense of the word,
precisely.
they had restrictions put on them.
Severe restrictions. I mean, so travel on the train, you were restricted to one or two carriages on the train. And then the trains that are in the townships were just disgraceful.
Yes.
And they were packed beyond what is reasonable. The townships themselves, one lived in conditions which are an affront, really, to human dignity.
Yeah.
I mean, in my own case, for example, I didn't have a sleep in my own bedroom till I was 20 years old when I came to Manchester to study at
Royal
College of Music. I shared a bedroom with my brother and two sisters.
Oh, my goodness. Because I assume then you had like a two-bedroom house. That you were growing up in South Africa.
In the township.
In the township.
Exactly.
And you used to live under the curfews?
Well, look, my father was one of the founder members of the New Unity Movement, which was one of the political movements dedicated to changing society and the end of apartheid. And he was one of those people that whenever there was an uprising, he would be disappeared in the night by special branch. He'd be arrested and kept at the state's pleasure for however long they decided to keep him.
Right.
And my mother was always left behind to hold the family together.
Wow.
And he was always banned under what they call the Suppression of Communism Act, which meant, really, they just used the language of the Cold War to justify apartheid. But it meant that we couldn't have visitors in our house. Even his parents, when they came to visit, had to be outside the gate. So the last time he saw his parents was over the gate at our home. And in fact, my younger sister didn't know this, and she was so traumatized when I told her that even my father's parents, our grandparents, couldn't come into our house. We had no visitors because anybody that did come to visit would be arrested by special branch.
Right. So they just...
So this was a kind of the environment. The other thing which, for me, was a troubling thing then, but which I didn't understand, was As a young kid, I used to wake up in the night, I thought. And I'd have memories of men in dark suits in my room.
Ah, and you'd think that this was just dreams of a young boy. Dreams,
but this was the truth.
It was actually happening.
Yes. Our house being raided by Special Branch Police. And in my bedroom were bookshelves. My father was an avid reader, and look, that's where I developed my love for reading.
Right.
But every month they would issue a gazette in which they added to the list of banned literature.
Right.
And they would spring a surprise in the middle of the night to raid our house to find banned literature in order that they could arrest and detain my father.
Right. Just always looking for reasons to arrest him and get him away from being the influence that he clearly was.
Sure. I mean, he died at the very young age of 56, but he was an incredible influence. There are trade unionists in South Africa today. Mm. I mean, he's been dead nearly 30 years. That he trained. There are people that he gave political education to. There are people that he taught at school. He was banned from the teaching profession because he felt they didn't want somebody that taught people to think to be in the schools.
Right.
So every profession he entered, he was banned from.
You are like the poster child of hope because you've had an horrendous upbringing. Very difficult because it's not only that you saw it going on from the outside, but it was coming from it was actually coming into your home, coming into your bedroom, coming into every area of your life that should have been intimate and safe.
Absolutely.
We all have our safe zones, right?
There was nothing safe for me.
Nothing.
Nothing. The Special Branch intruded in every aspect of my life. When I was at university, for example, I studied music. And a very young flautist came to study. And I was pretty young. I was 17 then. And this was my first experience of love. Lindy Munich, she's now married, called Lindy Leviston. I hadn't seen, I reestablished contact with her, but I realized that there was something going on in terms of personal relationships. But I knew also that it was illegal to have a relationship with a young white South African woman.
Right.
That both of us would end up in prison. So I tried to do what I thought was the right thing to do, and I told her that actually we should terminate our relationship. And she cried, and she stormed off, very hurt. And I, more than 30 years later, I had a request on Facebook, a friendship request, by somebody called Lindy Leviston. And this was Lindy from the parted years. So even something as normal as
falling
in love was interfered with by the state.
Right.
And I mean, I have to say that the effect upon her was far worse than me.
What? Really?
She felt that she would have been willing to take the risk and to make the sacrifice
in order to pursue love.
Her love for me was real.
Yeah.
And that nothing would be an obstacle to that. But I didn't give the chance, she said. And I feel profoundly sad about that because I was able to get on with my life much more easily than she did.
Right, right.
But be that as it may, life is lived in a forwardly direction. And I was reminded of this particular episode of Forbidden Love when I went to a lecture at the South Bank here in London, where some academic or some woman from one of the great universities had written a fictitious little novel about forbidden love.
Oh.
And I felt that there was an affront to Lindy. So I went to the lecture and I intended fully to question it, to say, look, how dare you profit from human misery? And that's a made-up story. Why don't you write something based on truth, which is even more painful? But I sat there and I remained silent.
Because you just didn't want to rock the boat and you thought this was not the platform to do that.
Precisely.
Now, how then, because you started to study music when you were 16, having left prison. Mm-hmm. So how long, if you don't mind me asking, I'm not trying to go back to that part of the story, but how long did you stay in prison?
Well, look, the detention, there's the security part, prison part, and then there was the Woodstock police station part.
Right.
So a total of a month. And then trial.
That's horrendous.
I was on bail for about a few months. Strict conditions to report the police station twice a day in the morning between 7 and 8.
Well, you're still in prison.
And so basically I was on the train all day and the buses trying to get to the police station to prove that I hadn't skipped the country.
Yes, exactly. So, and probably until you went to university, you were still in prison.
Look, it stays with you. I mean, the apartheid was not just a question of your physical isolation, it was also what it does to your mind.
Right.
The ghetto is not a physical place. The ghetto is also a state of mind.
There. And this is what we're facing right now.
Precisely.
With all the crime.
Yes.
And they're all saying all these different reasons why people are turning to gangs and to crime. But this is why I'm saying you're the poster child of hope, right? Because for some reason you ran from an incredibly impossible situation because you knew everything. I mean, it's not like here when we think and we assume and we are we're having to put the dots together and say, look, things are stacked against us. In South Africa, it was stacked against you. It was by law stacked against you. And yet you came out of this and you attached yourself to music Look, somehow.
I was always a fighter. I never give up with anything.
Right.
If I believe it's worth fighting for...
You fight.
To my last drop of blood, I will fight. So I went to university. I auditioned to go to music college.
Was that from your father and your mother instilling that in you, that no matter what happens... Still be educated? Was that?
I mean, I had very enlightened parents who knew that the only route to emancipation was education.
Yes, knowledge.
Knowledge. And the rational application of that knowledge.
Right.
A sterile knowledge is pointless.
Yes, yes.
It is wisdom which allows one to be able to implement this knowledge. And I learned very early on. I became a voracious reader. And also I learned the value of every experience that I had. So I went to university. I was in a hostile environment. I was a cellist to begin with. I auditioned and I didn't believe I'd get in because my audition was such a disaster. But I was offered a place. And when I arrived at music college, there were all these people, white South Africans, who had been to the best possible schools, had the best possible education.
Right.
And the deficit I had was enormous. And at that point, I realized I had two options. I could either fight or I could give up. And I decided to fight. So from that day forth, I was at university between 10 and 12 hours a day. I practiced 8 hours a day, minimum, every day, 7 days a week.
Wow.
I was in the library all the time. I listened to records. I went to listen to people practice. I had to learn things.
Yes.
Frequently.
And this is all additional to what you were having to do on the course anyway.
Absolutely.
So you were doing all your school course, all of the essays, everything else that you had to do. And then this was on top of all of that.
Absolutely. I knew that I had to be focused and that there was no negotiation. I just had to do it.
But why music? Why did you not, because I know you'd said that you have a master's in international...
Relations and secret intelligence. Right.
So why did you not go the political route and use your voice? Why did you turn to music?
Early on in South Africa, having been a political prisoner, going down the political route was impossible.
Right.
I was not given permission to study law, even, for example. I refused permission for that. To study politics would have been impossible. So I chose something safe, like music. But then I realized, as I developed as a musician, that music was almost the perfect means of resistance.
Wow.
You did not have to open your mouth. You just played.
Right.
But, of course, you know, because the institutions are run by hostile people, hostile to the interests of people like myself, opportunities weren't that many. For example, you know, they used to have exchange concerts between the universities. However well you played, if you're a person of color, you never got chosen to play in those concerts. But the saving grace for me was that 4 years of practicing 10 hours a day gave me something which I didn't realize. I was a world-class bass player after practicing for 4 years.
Wow.
Because when I arrived in the United Kingdom, I realized that I'd exceeded what most people achieve at these beautiful music colleges in
Wow.
But I worked basically in isolation with only recordings and my teacher Zoltan Kovats and also Max Runger to guide me.
Wow.
And they were fabulous. There were a handful of people in South Africa who were very helpful. But the turning point for me came when Sir John Manduel, who was the head of the music college in Manchester, but also he ran the Cheltenham Music Festival, you know, one of Britain's great human beings. I didn't realize at the time, but he was South African born. He came to South Africa as external examiner for the final recital diplomas. And he gave me 95%. The highest mark ever awarded in the history of the University of Cape Town for a performance degree. And he invited me to come to England.
Wow.
And I had already nurtured this dream of leaving South Africa.
Mm.
So I made a friend of a travel agent because I wasn't allowed a passport in those days because I had been critical of the South African regime. I made a friend of a travel agent who got me a passport on a Friday afternoon and I left the country on a Sunday. And I lived in the United Kingdom as a refugee.
That is amazing. So, sorry, I just have to quickly ask then. So, when you left, that meant you left your family?
Yes.
Your mother, your brothers, your sister?
Forever.
Wow. Have you ever seen them since?
Of course, history changed. When I left, I presumed it would be forever because apartheid seemed so permanent.
It did.
Yes.
It really did. I remember speaking to a woman who went to join the apartheid. And when she was leaving here, Britain, she was a black woman, and she was leaving here, And they begged her not to go for 3 days. Yes. They begged her not to go, and they finally gave her the visa. The moment she landed in the country, they took her passport, arrested her, and then turned to her and said, "Where did you get this passport from?" And she was like, "You saw me just get off the plane. I'm from England." 3 days they detained her before they let her out. And then a year later, apartheid fell. Yes. So, yes, you're right. It's that thing of, it was forever, wasn't it?
Because when I left, it was forever. My parents came to the airport, and I had a photograph of them seeing me off. I had a brand new raincoat and a suitcase. And I arrived here on the 4th of January, 1982, with a raincoat, a suitcase, and a dream.
Yeah, but you must have had a mixture of this, the whole world had just opened up to you. So an unbelievable excitement, but then also the loss, the grief of having to say goodbye to your family forever.
But, you know, look, I realized that I had taken this step, and I was happy to do that.
How old were you at this point?
This is 1992, so I was 20.
20?
Yes.
You were still a child. Sorry, I'm sorry. I'm getting deep into your stories. Tell me you've not written this book yet, because I should have read it.
You're absolutely right. I've written 50 pages of the book.
We cannot wait to read it. Seriously, you've got to come back on as soon as you've read it. We'll have a live audience and we'll talk about, this is a brilliant story. We haven't even touched your music yet. Yeah. And we've got 5 minutes left. I'm so sorry, but carry on.
Look, so I arrived in Manchester and I went as a postgraduate at the Royal Northern College of Music. And just to condense the whole musical story, I had to, this friend of mine asked me that, so when you look backwards, what do you see? So this is what I can look back at. I can look back upon a career as a principal double bass player in the Manchester Camerata for 11 years, the London Motor Players, and the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields for 20 years.
Wow.
The Academy is probably the world's most famous orchestra.
Right.
And I enjoyed my time with Sir Neville Mariner, and I left in 4 years ago, August 2014, will be 5 years soon.
Oh, but my goodness. Fabulous
career. I also played with just about every orchestra imaginable. As a chamber musician, I've worked with some of the greatest musicians on the planet. It's been my first ever chart quintet, for example, was with the Amadeus Quartet.
Right.
A legendary British quartet. I worked with the Lindsays for 20 years. And as a soloist, I've played, God knows, hundreds of concerto performances and maybe a few thousand recitals. And then comes the question of my contribution to commercial music. So I've played probably, I've recorded about 7,500 pop tracks. So if you listen to Madonna, you like to hear my bass somewhere in the background. If you listen to Robin Williams, the Spice Girls, you name it.
Oh, how versatile. How wonderful. Yeah. Oh, you're not pompous at all. You know what I mean? And I'm not saying that classical players are normally pompous. They're not. But what I mean is, it's like your appreciation for music is wide and broad. Yeah. And it's just...
I mean, I was never going to be narrow in my outlook. So take films, for example. You know, most people know the James Bond films.
Yes.
I've played every James Bond film since 1995, except the last one. The Lord of the Rings. 2,000 films over a period of 20-odd years. But also, I've been a pedagogue, been teaching. So I've been teaching over 30 years. I started coaching the bass players in the Knowsley Youth Orchestra, in Liverpool area.
Yes.
I've coached the National Youth Orchestra, the National Youth String Orchestra, the iCulture Orchestra in Poland, the Miyagi Orchestra in South Africa, South African National Youth Orchestra. But I've started a new career as a conductor. So when I left the academy, Sir Neville said, "So what are you going to do next?" And I said, "Well, I'm not sure." And he said, "I think you should become a conductor." And
that's powerful, isn't it?
Yes, and he explained to me why he thought I should do it. And I realized,
gosh,
he's right.
Why do I want to cry right now? This is such a powerful, powerful story.
Well, you know, it's just my particular route through life. Everybody has a journey. But most of the things that happened to me have been wonderful opportunities. I make the best of everything that comes my way. I'm never sad. I'm always optimistic. And whatever I have to do is never difficult. It's always a challenge to rise to.
Right. But do you think that's maybe why you are here today and who you are today? Because of your attitude to life, to embracing life. It's like you have such this deep respect for life itself.
It's a privilege to wake up every morning.
Yeah.
And I think to myself, every day I wake up, I have another opportunity. You know, my journey is not a personal one. I have a responsibility to life. Also, we can't control very much in life, except you can control your attitude to life.
Right.
So I make the very most of having a positive attitude to everything that I encounter. A positive attitude to human beings.
Yes.
When somebody's in pain, they're in pain, and you have to understand that, and you have to help them through their difficulties. To be angry is pointless. To be vindictive is pointless. Hatred is pointless.
It's pointless because it stops you being able to think. It takes over all of your emotions, and so therefore, what can you do? You can't change the situation. You can't rise above it. I mean, look at you. I mean, it's like you are stripped away everyone's excuse for why they went to crime and why they are so angry and why. You've literally stripped away their excuses for not having achieved and become who they were meant to be.
Absolutely. We all have the possibility to do wonderful things in life. Yeah. Yes, we should release our energy to be able to accomplish that. You know, society, of course, it's not as if society is not without problems. But one should look upon these problems as, you know, look for the solutions rather than just to revel in it or to, you know, just to see it as problematic. The question of politics, for example, I've been excluded from politics, really, for most of my life. I mean, part of the conditions under which I was allowed to stay as a refugee in Britain was that I was not allowed to be politically active.
So even when you came to England, where it's meant to be the land of the free,
exactly,
they still put restrictions on you?
There were restrictions. And I mean...
How interesting.
So I felt that I could never speak up, I could never say anything for fear of having my refugee status revoked. Wow. So I became a very quiet political citizen. But I realized, you know, I'm a British citizen now, of course, I have been for some time. But the way I expressed my politics was I went back to university. So I studied international relations and intelligence.
Right.
Because when I arrived here from South Africa, I realized that actually I'd been quite stupid. I'd been fighting a national revolution in international society. This is impossible. How could you possibly succeed with a national revolution? So I thought that I would go to university to test my ideas amongst those people who knew better than I.
Oh, that is so amazing. What a fantastic approach.
So that's why I went back to university, and I was put on this course, International Relations and Intelligence, which was the first time they did this particular course at Salford University, Manchester. Wow. And I found it fabulous. And the thing I was very good at was analysis. And I wrote my thesis before the South African election of 1994, when I predicted what would happen to the South African state. And I look back now, here we are, and exactly everything I said that was going to happen has happened.
Wow.
I predicted that the ANC would implode, and it has.
Yes.
There are consequences. And I also predicted that there would be no change for the population of South Africa. They would continue to be impoverished, and that apartheid would remain structurally, but that the management team would change.
Just change.
Yes.
And that's exactly what has happened.
So now I'm in the position where I think I'm going to become a little bit more active in expressing my opinions about how I see the world and I see the future. Because I do have a little bit of a gift for understanding politics.
Right, and then finding a way to communicate it.
Exactly.
Which may be not in the way people are expecting.
You see, the South African regime were terrified of me because I had the ability to be able to stand up and to speak and to persuade people to take action.
Yes.
And that's not always the safest thing to do.
Right.
When it comes to your own personal safety. But writing is a much more measured way of contributing to the future. So in music also, for example, I've developed an algorithm for how to learn music effectively and quickly.
Oh, wow.
So I have to write my algorithm up quickly before somebody else does, because I use this in public, my teaching method. Also, I've realized that classical music itself is not dead. We all talk about music is dying. It's not the music that is dying, it's the paradigm that is dead.
Wow.
So I've started writing a book called Classical Music, A New Paradigm.
Oh, I love it. You're so right, because it hasn't changed. It is still just as powerful as it ever was, but it's our relationship to it, isn't it?
This is true.
It's how society has changed around it. And so then, how do we then?
Yeah.
And so you found a way to let it live.
I've identified something I think lies at the center of being what classical music ought to be for all of us.
You are your own, like Game of Thrones. I know that sounds funny. I love the show, but it's like I feel like I've just watched an entire series of Game of Thrones. I feel all that same kind of, oh my God, the highs, the lows, the, oh my God, it's like, yes.
And the story travels so far, like from one end, it starts off from some simple little thing as a castle in Winterfell, you know, and then goes off all over the world.
All over the world.
And that's what your life is like.
Yes, and it's not even, I feel like we've only seen the tip of the iceberg, even though it's been massive and it's been full and it's been long, but it feels like but the greatest is now about to begin.
Exactly. I mean, at the age of 58 next birthday in June.
Oh, wow. I feel you're looking good. Thank you. It's amazing.
Look, I'm an ultramarathon runner as well.
There you go.
But I've realized that now I'm ready for life. The first 57 years were preparation. Now you're ready.
Oh, how awesome.
Wow. I've done that when I hit 50.
Right. Yes. I'm sorry. So we've got 2 minutes left. And I know we're going to be playing. What we'll do is we'll play some of your music as we go out because people need to hear your amazing music. But also, I know that Rebecca would kill me if we did not talk about the African concert series.
The 2nd of May.
The 2nd of May is the next one. It's at the October Art Gallery.
Correct. And I'm playing 4 pieces. It's part of my South African Dubbies project. And Rebecca's my new duo partner. 4 pieces, 2 of which have never been played. So 2 world premieres.
Oh, wow.
Isipho by Peter Glatzer. And Isipho means gift.
Right.
And then Nocturne by David Earle. And then I will play Sonatina by McLachlan that was written for me in 2016.
Wonderful.
And the first piece is by Michael Fillion. And it's about embodying some optimism for the future of South Africa.
Right. And if you know it, can you remind us the best place for people to buy tickets?
Look, I can't tell you those details, but okay. It's online.
It is online, and we'll make sure we'll tweet it all out. Because I always say, I know that you can go to the October Art Gallery, but I do remember someone saying, no, it's easier to get it somewhere else. So we will find the link, and we'll make sure on the Colourful Radio, we'll make sure we get the link out so that people can actually book their tickets. And
the date
is the 2nd of May at 6 p.m. is it?
Yes, and it's my mother's birthday. She would have been. It would have been a delight to still have her here, but unfortunately, she moved on to.
You know, your mum and dad are going to be sitting in that room with us because you know I'm going to be there. I don't know what's in my diary, but I'm going to be clear of my diary. I can't even imagine the tears of joy they must cry every day at your life.
Look, she sacrificed so much to make my life possible. So the concert on the 2nd of May will be dedicated to my mother.
Oh, that is so beautiful. I've wanted to cry this entire show. Leon, thank you so much for being here. We've literally come to the end of the show right now. But you are more than welcome to come back, especially as you go on the different parts of your journey.
Well, thank you for being such a wonderful host.
Oh, no. I feel like I've just been... That's how I feel like I've been talking. Oh. What an amazing journey.
Thank you. I'll come back. It'd be a pleasure to come and add to the next chapter.
Sorry. Yes, with a live audience, because people have got to experience it. It's like your aura and your presence, it goes with it. It goes with the whole... I cannot wait for the next chapter in your life. It's going to be phenomenal. Okay, so thank you again to Leon Bosch for being with us today. Thank you for Pixie. She's going to be sticking around. And we're going to have a little bit of music now. We're going to hear some of Leon's music as we close this morning. And then we're going to have some news, we're going to have some ads. And then when we come back, we've got with us in the studio, Yemi Eden. He is back with us again, which is absolutely wonderful, from the CEO of Daniel Ford International. We're going to be talking a little bit about property. So if you're one of those people who are really longing to get on the property ladder, please do not go anywhere. Yemi has got so many good tips and advice to give us and to share about his story. But... oh gosh, I feel like applauding Leon Bosch. Thank you so much for sharing so much of your story.
My pleasure.
Absolutely phenomenal. Okay, so we're going to close this section now with a little bit of Leon Bosch.
Thank you.
Jacqueline Malcolm. Colour.